Hello, and welcome back to another edition of New Books in Intellectual History. I'm your host, Todd Weir. Today, it's my pleasure to speak to the author of The Romantic Machine, Utopian Science and Technology After Napoleon, John Tresh, who is professor of, I'm going to not know your entire title, of the History of and Sociology of Science at the University of Pennsylvania. So, John, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Hi. I'm great. Really glad to be here.
Wonderful. So we were speaking a bit in the pre-interview about the some of the issues that that I, as an interviewer, bring to this interview, and that is that I really am familiar with the German case fairly well, but not so well with the French case. And this is a marvelous book for me to read just because it opens up a whole world. It's not really, I would say, history of science as much as it's a sort of history of a civilization, of Paris in the period between 1818 and roughly 1850. So it's a wonderful illumination of that period in that city, and it opens up many more questions than a sort of standard history of science. The big questions are right there in the title. You know, what is the romantic and what is technology in this period? And I think John does some fascinating investigations of this field. First of all, just congratulations on a wonderful book.
Thank you.
And as a historian of Germany, I thought I would just start off with the German perspective, maybe a somewhat hackneyed, cliched perspective of Romanticism from the point of view of German history. And many people in who are familiar with George Lukács will know that he wrote a book in the early 1950s called The Destruction of Reason. And in this book, he charts a long history of opposition between the Enlightenment and Romanticism. And it's rather than seeing Romanticism as that which followed the Enlightenment, he really describes the relationship between the two as something of an ongoing battle through modernity. And that, you know, we have a very clear sense of dichotomies emerging in a kind of standard view of the relationship of Enlightenment and Romanticism. And that would be that on the side of Enlightenment, we have rationality, mechanism, criticism, cosmopolitanism, liberalism, progress, optimism, secularization. And on the other side of Romanticism, we have organic thought, organicism, irrationality, conservatism, eventually fascism, nationalism, religion, and pessimism. So I think that's the kind of inherent view that we have when we think about Romanticism. And what this book does is obviously complicate this picture quite a bit. I thought maybe that, John, if you could tell us a bit about the ways in which historians of science have been criticizing that perspective. Even before you get to your own work, which I think does chart sort of a new territory for us, but could you maybe sum up some of the discussions that have taken place in your field over Romanticism and science, perhaps before we even get to technology?
Sure. The question, the way in which Lukács frames it, I think, does still affect the way history of science approaches the question of Romanticism and in its relation to Enlightenment or all of these other forces of good, as he puts in his column, in the first column that you just listed. Frequently, when you're looking at the 19th century, what you're arguing with is not so much the 19th century, but with the 20th century. And that characterization post-World War II has really affected the way people have gone back to look at what is good and worth saving or worth valorizing in the 19th century and what led to the disasters of the 20th century. And that has kind of fallen down very much in the way Lukács and you just summarized it with this idea that the Enlightenment was primarily this on the side of the angels and Romanticism was this dark, irrational force that led to basically fascism. And there, it's an ongoing debate in history of science, wrestling with the positive sides of the Enlightenment, but then following Foucault and also Adorno and Horkheimer, looking at some of the negative moments in the dialectic of Enlightenment. And so there's the sense that the Enlightenment had many optimistic projects and in many ways brought about reforms towards a more open society. And yet, underneath that, or in dialectic with that, was a tendency for kind of obsessive control and limitation and restriction. Whether that's in the form of a kind of metaphysical limitation and reductionism, or in the world of politics or of everyday life, you know, building structures to contain people. So that has not been absent from history of science. How does it play out in thinking about romantic science or science in the early 19th century? Well, for a long time, the most interesting thing in the early 19th century was mechanism and the emergence of a unified doctrine of scientific method and new exciting explanations of the universe in a non-theological register. And Laplace is somebody who's associated with that a lot, the Marquis de Laplace. And his vision of a deterministic science and a deterministic universe, the kind of accomplishment or conclusion or final triumph of Newton in his celestial mechanics, Laplace finally validated Newton and corrected the perturbations in his treatment of the solar system, and then applied that to the terrestrial domain, applied it to physics on Earth, so in light, heat, electricity, and magnetism. And so for a lot of historians of science of, say, a generation earlier, or two maybe, some of the students of Thomas Kuhn, for instance, there is so much writing on the physicists around Laplace and the transition from Laplacian mechanism to other things, but particularly thermodynamics, the study of steam engines, and the new kinds of explanations of matter and of force that show up with thermodynamics, and these new kinds of machines. So that was a big obsession, and still is in a lot of ways, in the study of 19th century physics. And the physics was really the thing that people, especially in France, were most interested in. That kind of science lends itself very well to an association with the Enlightenment, of course, because it's continuing Newton, it's continuing the idea of reductionism, the clockwork universe. And whether you're pro or for or against that, it looks a lot like the Enlightenment that Lukács is sketching out, whether you're emphasizing the beneficial or the kind of ominous aspects of that. On the other hand, in biology, which is a term that's just coined right around this period by Lamarck, in biology, there's somewhat of an interest in how Newtonian or mechanizing approaches might deal with the strange phenomena of life. And there, the emphasis has been much more on the possible influence of things like romanticism, of ideas that are holistic or very attuned, of course, to organisms, to explanations of matter that might not be as reductive as just this passive entity that forces push along in a neutral way. So vitalism is a big part of the debate in at the time in biology. And, of course, that's something historians of science have picked up on, too. There is a longstanding tendency in history of science, at least, you know, going back to the moment that Lukács is writing, to the middle of the 20th century, to want to make of Newton and the successors of Newton the real heroes in the story of history of science period. So that every science that finally becomes a true science is one that begins to make only mechanical explanations for all of its phenomena and runs crucial experiments like Newton is said to have done and makes its explanations in terms of laws, of mathematical and mechanical laws. So that's a perfect incitement to study Laplace and his students who are trying to do that to more and more domains of the world. But it creates a problem for studying biology, which doesn't easily lend itself to that kind of mechanistic Newtonian explanation. And it's actually what people in the 19th century are wrestling with. So people who've tried to make sense of what went on in the 19th century are attuned to these other kinds of influences, particularly from Naturphilosophy, Schelling's school of kind of very total philosophy following Kant, where the identity between mind and nature is assumed as the kind of prior condition or the starting point of the world and therefore of philosophy, and where the kinds of forms of activity or forms of action that you find in living things and in minds might also have a role in the world of matter. And so thinking about organisms as resembling the mind is something that Schelling is pushing, and many people take it up, and it turns out to have a very big influence on the biology of the early 19th century, whether it's in terms of looking for archetypal forms in nature, which is something that Oken does, and then in France, that's picked up by a number of biologists or natural historians, including Geoffroy Saint-Hilaire, or focusing on the processes of development, the holistic nature of organisms, their connections to their conditions of existence, to their ecological niches, and then thinking about the earth and life in general as an organism, right? Organisms made up of other organisms. So that's an influence of Schelling that historians of biology have recognized as actually very important for what's going on in the 19th century. So recently, scholars have focused on that, on the beneficial side of Romanticism in contributing to biology. And Robert Richards is just one really notable name there with this great book on the Romantic conception of life, which basically traces German Naturphilosophy in its various roots and its impact on biological thinking, including Goethe's thought, but sets it all up as the precursors to Darwin, who, after the 1950s, was celebrated as this anti-romantic, mechanistic, biological thinker, one who finally rid us of the specter of teleology, right, of there being a final goal in organisms. And Richards really corrects that misperception, showing how much Darwin relied on and really is following thinkers like Alexander von Humboldt, and through him, this whole tradition of Naturphilosophy and organic romantic philosophy of organisms. But what's starting to happen, and what's already there in some of the work of Thomas Kuhn, for instance, in looking at the history of thermodynamics, is a recognition that even in physics, notions associated with romantic philosophy have an impact. So that the idea of looking at conversions among different states of energy, which is there, not exactly in those words, but it's there in Schelling, that winds up influencing a lot of the people who lay the groundworks for thermodynamics, which is also influenced by the study of machines, of steam engines. And some other historians of science, or often ones who are interested in philosophy of science and the impact of Kant on the study of physics, like Michael Friedman or Robert Brain or Norton Wise, are showing how important Naturphilosophy was, not just for biology, but for physics. And so that's part of where this book is an intervention, or that's what I'm contributing to, and trying to show that those developments happen obviously simultaneously, that what's going on in romantic thought contributing to the theory of organisms is connected to through various people, through various concepts, through various practices, and thinking about new developments and inventions it's connected to what's going on in the study and development of new kinds of technology and the theory of where those technologies are headed.
I think that I found particularly interesting in your book was the way that you do take some of these notions from biology and look at how they are being translated into thinking about technology. And what I want to as I mentioned in the pre-interview, I had just recently looked at the book by Bob Richards you just mentioned, and he has the useful distinction in there between what he refers to as sort of a Kantian mechanism, which presupposes that there are archetypes in biology, but that these are, in a sense, that one accepts them as given, but one analyzes then mechanistically the operations of nature. And yeah. That with Goethe and the Romantics, the idea was that the archetype had to be connected to the operations of the organism. And it was just a sort of useful way of thinking about the ways in which that some of the Romantic thinkers brought history into the life of the organism itself, and the notion of evolution of organisms, both in their lifetimes, but also in the development of a species, is sort of mark of that shift. Really,
yeah.
What's interesting then to me, I suppose, in thinking about your work is that instead of obviously, if we take biology, we can still operate in this kind of idea of romanticism as something that takes place in the Lake District, the Alps, small German towns, where it's much very much about the connection of the individual genius to nature. Yeah. This is an important part of Humboldt's idea of the aesthetic aspects of scientific inquiry, mm-hmm. but they would all seem to aim at sort of reintegrating with nature in a natural setting.
Yeah.
Whereas what's so interesting about your book is that you're taking us to the Moloch, right uh-huh. into Paris, the capital of the 19th century, uh-huh. into machines, In that way, it seems to me there's at least the first intervention of your book and how it differs, say, from what Bob Richards has done. So I just wanted you to open up a bit this notion of how what is a romantic theory of technology or, just what is a romantic machine? What do you mean by that?
Well, I contrast it with a classical machine, which is one where the motive force is external to it. And I'm thinking of Descartes, where Descartes got a world which is matter and motion, and that's all you need, or Newton, much more because he's really championed at the end of the 18th century, where the world is passive matter, which is pushed around by forces which are outside of it. And in both cases, that's all about a simply numerical explanation of movement or a force. And so Descartes and Newton is kind of the exemplars of how to think about a clock or how to think about a machine. What is the exemplary machine? So that it's something which has a lot of parts that fit together that are moved by an external force in a completely transparent way, so that a lever passes along the force on one end to the other end. And the lever itself, you don't really have to think about. You just have to think about the input and the equivalent output on the other side of that lever or the other side of that balance. And Norton Wise has written about the balance as being the kind of symbol of the Enlightenment machine, where things add up on either side of the equation, input and output. With the Romantic machine, which I'm using to apply to a lot of different technologies that show up in the early 19th century. Some of them exist already, but get reinterpreted in this new framework. But some of them are new, like the steam engine, and that really is the exemplary one, where it's the clock in the 18th century or the classical era. The steam engine becomes the exemplary machine in the period I'm looking at, and there's the sense that force is internal to the machine that. It's harnessed and developed by the machine and then converted by the machine. There isn't this complete equivalence between input and output. And that's really clear in the case of the steam engine that in thermodynamics, where soon enough there will be the notion of entropy, that there is loss in any system, right? The energy goes into a corrupted form over the course of a process. And that's something that one of the characters in the book, Carnot, theorizes in his theory of the motive force of heat. And he's not entirely given up the notion of heat as being a distinct fluid, but he does insist on this idea that work is done by a difference in heat in between a hot and a low temperature and between two bodies, and that over time that there's always going to be a loss in a productive engine. So you don't have this perfect system of an irreversible system of the inputs and outputs matching each other. And so that sense that a machine is bringing about a transformation or a conversion of energy from one state to another, right? The turning fire into productive force in the case of a steam engine, right? You're taking coal and setting on fire, heating water that produces steam, and then that's turned into the movement of a steam engine, the movement of a train or of a machine in a factory. That imaginary power or that image really affects how people think about machines in general at this time. Looking at both the conversions and the transformations and also the losses that you think about machines, engineers are thinking about machines not simply in this ideal abstract mode, but also thinking physically about machines in terms of friction and the way in which they lose speed or momentum or force over time in their actual functioning. So there's a turn from a machine which is kind of an ideal of perfect transmission of input and output to one which is very embedded in the concrete and material, where conversions are effected and where there's loss, where there's destruction, but also novelty, where you pass from, say, coal, this solid, to this very different kind of phenomenon, which is motive force.
But how is that? What makes that specifically a romantic? I mean, I understand the technological innovations, but in what sense can you interpret that then as a romantic device?
If the inputs and outputs are the same, then time really doesn't matter in a clock in an exemplary 18th century machine, right? If you get the same thing on either side, the system's ultimately irreversible. But exactly as you point out, one of the big ideas in romantic theory of life is this insistence on evolution, on transformism, on things happening as processes, not being the same at the start as they are at the finish, and also that those processes are irreversible. So in this machine, you've got this notion, in something like a steam engine, you've got this key new mode of temporality, this insistence on process, on development, on the production of something that didn't exist before out of this chain of conversions. Also, the idea of life, right, that there is this kind of dynamic force which is incredibly difficult to contain, which is about conversion, is about metamorphosis, transmutation. A lot of thinkers at that time transfer the notion of life from living things to, or things that we think of living things like animals and humans, transfer that to things that in a more 18th century view, well, depending on who you ask in the 18th century, but in a Newtonian view, do not possess life. Things like steam engines. So there's also a kind of contagion of dynamism, of metamorphosis, of ideas of life and vitalism that goes from living things to machines. And
could you give one of the great things about this book is that you spend a lot of time actually with literary sources. Obviously what you're talking about, it will be, you know, captured, I think, primarily even in the sort of the public sphere in terms of popular writing. Can you give any examples where people talk about machines in this kind of
sure.
Organic sense of almost having being beings, being living objects, or how does that reflect itself in popular culture?
Sure. There's a new movement in literature, which is part of the fall of Napoleon, that under Napoleon there was a lot of censorship, especially of writings coming from Germany. And after Napoleon falls, all of the literary and philosophical development in Germany is now available, and a lot of people are translating it, like Madame de Stael or Benjamin Constant, or Alexander von Humboldt is one of the vectors for German thought. But this, just as that's influential in philosophy, political philosophy, aesthetics, and science, it's influential in literature. And suddenly in the 1820s, people are reading Goethe, they're reading Schiller, and they're also reading E.T.A. Hoffmann, the fantastic author, the author of these great short stories, where the focus is on producing the effect of the uncanny, where something looks like it's inert, dead, immobile, and then eerily it comes to life. It's reinvigorated with some kind of spirit, or it channels some other world. It becomes a portal to another world. And fantastic literature, this is, you know, a twist on the Gothic. It influences fantasy writing, horror writing, has a huge impact on all the European literatures in the 1820s. And it's translated into French, and people go wild over it and start writing a lot of fantastic tales. And frequently what happens in those stories is some inert object, which, as I've just said, comes to life. Those are often machines that come to life, or like automata, machines that are designed to look like animals or humans. They move in an uncanny, lifelike, magical, and very eerie way. So it's not often the case that someone is saying a steam engine is the same as a living thing, although people are frequently arguing things along those lines. That perhaps the same force that lies at the bottom of the energy driving the railroad or driving electromagnetism, powering the telegraph, at a deeper level, this may be the same force that leads to the production of life and of thought. And if you think of Frankenstein, what the reason that at the start Walton is going off to the North Pole is to find the secret of electricity and electromagnetism. That's a big part of physics and science, and earth science in particular. But the reason is to bring it back to, one of the reasons is to bring it back to biology, because there's a thought that the spark of life is electricity or magnetism. So this is something that's being pursued in science. In physics, in medicine, in biology, and then it's showing up in all of this sort of creepy, sort of disorienting, uncanny literature of the fantastic. That's in there's fantastic poetry, there's fantastic literature. The short story is really exemplary for this, and Balzac and Gautier, Nerval, many French thinkers really developed the short story in this way, around objects that come to life that are possessed with these uncanny effects. But it's also there in music, like in Berlioz's Symphonie Fantastique, which is meant to produce those same kinds of eerie effects of transportation into a different realm, a different mode of experience, or a different spiritual realm, into the afterlife, for instance, or into a dream or a hallucination. The way in which that's done is through these new instruments that Berlioz celebrates. Through new basses and bassoons that produce new kinds of sounds, and the overall orchestra imagined as a kind of organic machine that produces these eerie effects. So, you know, it's an image in literature, it's an image in the arts, but also it's an engine of literature and an engine in the arts to think about the material and mechanical aspects of the production of effects. The orchestra, but then a lot of thought about how the steam engine and the steam press, right? When you apply a steam engine to a press to produce many, many more copies of some printed work, can bring about all the effects that are there in literature, right? Bring it to more people, and then produce a change in people's minds, magically transform people's feelings and thoughts by exposing them to written text. But the place where that happens is the press, that machine. So in a lot of ways, you know, thinking both about machines as the content of the arts, but then machines as the infrastructure of the arts. You've got this transference from the engineering or scientific thinking of machines as bringing about metamorphosis and transformation, to thinking about machines bringing about those metamorphoses and transformations in the realm of literature, aesthetics, but then also, because it's about changing people's minds and thoughts, the realm of publicity and the realm of politics. To changing people's ideas about what the world might be like.
I was struck by the positive associations that people had with the artificiality of their technologies in a way. You know, there was the it was just sort of a train of thought that came. You were discussing the panoramas and and Humboldt suggesting that that if you could immerse someone in a 360 degree panorama or something, at least 180, it would approximate this this experience of being in nature. And you have a discussion of is it Daguerre, the painter, creating these dioramas with a lot of sort of special effects that people would go into a theater or a church and witness a sort of with music, a kind of slow, gradual shift of image brought about by a shifting color of lights. Mm-hmm. And the notion almost that, that these technical means were going to be positively seen as something that helps people have an aesthetic or a moral or a religious experience.
Yeah.
That it's not about realism per se necessarily. It's that as well, perhaps, but can you say a bit about that? There's a kind of an aesthetic theory of technology that seems to be emerging.
And it's more than an aesthetic one. I think it's also an epistemological one. It's about what is actually happening when we create knowledge. I mean, do we discover something that's already there, or are we somehow framing that, shaping that by the kinds of questions we ask to nature, by our machines, by our instruments, to produce new effects that then have to be framed by humans? And there are a lot of people in the sciences who are saying exactly that. And that's part of why this is, what's going on in Paris makes sense in part, just as what's going on in Germany and England, as a follow-up to Kant, where Kant is saying that knowledge has a large component that comes from humans and the categories that they, and the schematism that they apply to the intuitions of that are, just a kind of remote transmission from the unknowable thing in itself. So we are shaping the world, according to Kant, in regular universal ways. What happens in this next moment, and I think it's particularly visible in Paris, for the reasons you mentioned earlier, that this is a city, and the romanticism that develops there is about city things, and it's about the theater. It's about magic shows. It's about performances. It's not about escaping the built-up world of civilization and experiencing nature in the village or on the top of the mountain. I mean, it is those things, but not only. It's also producing those same kinds of experiences of nature inside the city, in part because Paris is this incredibly dense, active place, and people's imaginations are turned towards the kinds of experiences that they can have in its streets. And they are so in much more intensely at this period because the city's changing and people are thinking about what goes on in that city in particular, people in Paris, but also people outside of Paris. So there's this real interest in aesthetic experiences, which also have philosophical and religious aspects to them that we think of when we think of romanticism, right? Going to the mountain and hearing the voice of nature, or directly communing with the voice of nature, like the lake poets, or like a lot of German artists. But that's happening in a realm which is resolutely civilized, a realm which is the city, and a realm which is artificial, right? Where the streets are increasingly paved, where there's concrete and glass and all the achievements of technology. Those turn out not to be so firmly opposed, the city and the countryside, and the kind of civilization versus and the future and progress of the city versus the nostalgia simple nature outside the city. And that, I think, is kind of a key feature of the Romanticism in literature and the arts that shows up in Paris. This valorization and praise and fascination for the artificial, as you point out. All of the things that are supposed to be delivered by connecting directly with nature in the wild, or going to the tropics like Humboldt, or going back to small villages or standing on a cliff, those effects can be produced in the city, but the way to do that is not by fleeing from technology, but investing much more intensely in technology, thinking like Daguerre about how to make this really elaborate setup to produce these lighting effects, these shifting perspectives where a scene that looks like it's shot in winter, like you're seeing it in winter, slowly turns to a summertime scene, or a night scene turns into a daytime scene, or an empty church is suddenly filled with light and with people singing a mass. So there's often a kind of magical and supernatural effect and religious effect associated with these technologies. And of course, Daguerre is the person who managed to get his name attached to the daguerreotype, which is one of the first kinds of photography. So this is a technology which is celebrated by scientists, including François Arago, who's one of the astronomers who I talk about in the book, and he's the one who promotes Daguerre. It's celebrated by some as a realistic technology. It lets us capture the world as it actually is. But it's really important to see that that technology, the reason Daguerre is interested in it, is not to get a reductive capture of the world as it is. It's rather to produce these kinds of fantastic effects. And that the vision of the world that one receives through technology may be more true, may be more accurate than one receives directly. So there's a kind of effect that's both supernatural and also realistic. And there's a real oscillation between those two in a lot of the artistic technologies of the time. And I think that carries over to the way people think about scientific instruments and their use in consolidating truth about the natural world too. And so this same kind of weird dialectic between the artificial and the natural shows up in the sciences too. So go ahead.
So there's just I think I've mentioned Benjamin already, Walter Benjamin, but I'll mention him again. But there's a little, I think it's in the preface he wrote to the Arcades Project, which was his own engagement with much of the material you've worked through, where he talks about the fact that it's not until the early 19th century and precisely in Paris that the human imagination has the plastic means to form in reality that which can be envisioned in the imagination. So it's only when, with the advent of steel and glass, I think he says, that in a sense utopias can become real. So in this, it's just a nice sort of reversal from the way that people, I think, generally think of the relationship of utopia and technology. That for Benjamin, it's technology which allows what was utopian to become real, and in a sense, in these aesthetic games or these aesthetic devices that are being created by Daguerre and the others, it begs the question, to what degree are they conscious of what Benjamin is seeing, or is it just Benjamin's own vision? Are they actually envisaging an artificial reality that can bring about some kind of utopian society? Is that Benjamin's projection, or was it really there at the time? What's your take?
Oh, it's definitely there at the time, and I was guided a lot by Benjamin and his writing and his arcades, and part one way of thinking of the book was like, what would a Benjaminian history of science look like for this period? And to take some of these figures who he gives these just brilliant close readings to in a few pages or a page, and try to build up the context for why they were asking the questions they were doing, why did they produce the things that they produced, and to take this kaleidoscopic work and this incomplete work of the Arcades and take some small number of its insights and give it a more linear accounting, a more linear narrative. I very much agree with Benjamin on this point that the form that utopias take is a reflection of the means that are available to them. So people start dreaming in glass and steel when you have the technology to realize those kinds of cities. And the idea that utopia isn't going to be a place that is just a kind of thought experiment, right? A kind of critical location against which you can compare the failures of contemporary society, that it actually is something that can be built. That is a widespread idea in the early 19th century. And it's in part because of this, the real shakeups that organized application of industry is bringing about. And one of the places that shows up is in the work of the Saint-Simonians, who are a lot of them trained as engineers. Some of them are physicians who know very well what the capacities of machines are and start a reformist movement, which is definitely a utopian movement. And it's really one of the kernels of all the utopian movements of the 19th century, where their vision is of remaking society where productive force and labor is valorized and not birth and not inherited status. But rather what people do, what labor is. So workers and industrialists in general, which are workers, entrepreneurs, scientists, people who organize. These will be the leaders of the new society. And by allowing industry to develop in a planned way, right? By deciding, where to invest. And with cooperation between the state and some individuals, that's the way to bring about a much more harmonious and healthy society than the one where it's kind of wild competition and things left to chance and to whim. But the Saint-Simonians...
Are you suggesting that the society itself becomes a romantic machine or...
Definitely.
And
for the Saint-Simonians especially, and they, just to return to your starting question, they are very much interested in this idea of the artificial, that nature is not the state that we should be clinging to. It's against a certain reading of Rousseau that the golden age is in the past. The golden age instead is ahead of us. The golden age is in the future, and it's through throwing ourselves into technology, into artifice, that we produce this kind of earthly paradise. An artificial paradise, which is the term that Charles Baudelaire is using right at this period, reading all these people.
Just as to continue with this time period, I mean, we're 1840s. What about positivism? Because I think Auguste Comte, many people would see him as an anti-romantic, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
as somebody who the term positivism. As just sort of generally understood, would indicate a scientific view that would reject many of the notions of the Romantics. But you have a slightly different take here. Can you tell us about that?
Well, for one, he worked for Saint-Simon, who is this reformer, visionary industrialist that I just mentioned, and a lot of his ideas came through conversation with Saint-Simon's ideas, and he also develops his system of positive philosophy and then of positive polity, right, of positive politics in conversation or kind of in polemic with the Saint-Simonians. So we understand positivism, again, it's this the fact that to study the 19th century, you have to argue with the 20th century in a lot of ways. We understand positivism through neo-positivism, through logical empiricism, which is, has its own extremely interesting connections to scientific and political reform, but the standard view is the one you just recounted, that it's taking science as the last word. It's about reduction to the observable qualities of the world, and a very significant aspect of logical empiricism that is not there in Auguste Comte is the idea that there is a single logical language that will make it possible to tie together all the domains of science. So there's really a unity of science. And finding the right language to describe the world and is the key to reaching that unity. And also the idea that's implicit in our view of positivism, even if it's not necessarily accurate for even the neo-positivists, that the only things that matter are those things that we can study scientifically. The only true things are things that we can study scientifically. And the rest doesn't count. We have to pass over in silence, and therefore it's not important. So those aspects of positivism, part of what I I want to do by putting Auguste Comte as the kind of culmination of the story, as the second to last chapter, is to show that that is not actually accurate for this first moment of positivism. The guy who coined the term does not believe that there's a single method to explain everything. He doesn't believe that the sciences are united by a single language or by a single set of explanations or modes of reasoning. He has a multiplicitous view of the sciences. There are multiple sciences. The unity of science is about seeing the connections between them, but not in any way reducing them one to another. So each science has its own mode of explanation. Very important in this new hierarchy of the sciences that he puts forward is biology. Like, the turning point for him, the birth of positivism, is this vitalist thinker, physician, Bichat, Xavier Bichat, who says that to understand living things, you cannot use the methods of physics. Okay? You can't simply apply astronomy or terrestrial physics or mechanics to biology, because biology, living things have their own specificity. That's the key notion for Comte's positivism. It's not that there's unity and the potential of reduction of everything to one mode of explanation, but rather that the different levels of reality have their distinct autonomous principles of rationality. So in that sense, it's very much more in tune with the Romantic insistence on multiplicity and variety and diversity than it is with a kind of Enlightenment or neo-positivist reductionism. That's one aspect where Comte is much more in tune with Romanticism, even in his early writings, than an Enlightenment monism. But there's another aspect, which is the Church of Positivism, where the emotions and social organization are the key points for remaking science. You have to start by the emotions, you have to start with the imagination, and that's how you'll bring people into the positive age. And of course, that's, you know, totally romantic, that the imagination is this central force that all of us are using all the time to make the world. We're all more artists than we think, and it's in appealing to imagination that a new world, a utopian world, will be built.
That just as you were speaking there, I was at the end, particularly reminded, of course, about Alexander von Humboldt. Mm-hmm. And his work Cosmos, which you know, is an aesthetic opening to the reader to appreciate the entirety of the world, the cosmos, as an organized unity. Mm-hmm. And so I was there was a lot of thoughts come up, and again, I'm sorry to bring up Benjamin again. My goodness,
no, please.
But you know, I think what really attracted to Benjamin about this era and this the Romantics as well had to do with, I think, his own particular take on the notion of class consciousness in a revolutionary situation, and you know, Benjamin identifying with the Soviet Union. I'm not being a member of the party necessarily, but at any rate, thinking that there was some potential there in communism for a new type of collective consciousness, and what's really, of course, fascinating about Benjamin is the way that he brings technology into that equation. Right. And there's a famous passage, I'm sure you know it, from To the Planetarium, which he wrote, I think, in the late 20s, reflecting on the First World War and sort of saying that the First World War was this sort of engagement of humanity with technology, and that, you know, it kind of went badly in the first round and we had a horrible slaughter. But the notion being that if you know, if mankind could use technology, they could come to a self-understanding and a self-consciousness. Mm-hmm. So it wouldn't be a consciousness of technology, but rather the use of technology for people to have a new relationship to themselves, I guess, to come to some kind of a species consciousness, as Feuerbach would have said.
Yeah.
And there's a nice quote. I'll just read one since I have it here. Men as a species completed their development thousands of years ago, but mankind as a species is just beginning his. In technology, a physis is being organized through which mankind's contact with the cosmos takes a new and different form from that which it had in nations and families. It's an interesting notion, a sort of idea of a kind of consciousness, not an individual consciousness, but a truly collective social consciousness mediated through technology. Since you were just talking about Kant and we were thinking about Humboldt as well, it does seem to resonate with that period.
Definitely. And Benjamin is, very invested in his own time, which everyone is, and will later in the work of art in the age of its mechanical reproducibility say something very similar to the lines you just quoted, talking about film, about cinema, that there is a sense in which cinema has to cut up reality into these artificial fragments, right? You through editing and through the whole apparatus of making a film, you are doing something artificial. You're altering the kind of flow of time and the flow of experience. But through really thinking about that means of technique and thinking about what the content is, thinking about how the crowd is represented, thinking about representing the effect of the technology on experience in the art itself, there's the possibility of a new aura that may be recreated through technology. So we might be able to return to this kind of primitive state, which in his terms, where things speak to us. And this is Novalis. This is the blue flower, where the flower that speaks to us, where stones and animals all have a language, which we've lost. We've fallen away from. But with technology properly organized, we may be able to return to the blue flower in the land of technology. And he's thinking cinema might be one tool for that. But he is finding all of these anticipations of that way of thinking in the early 19th century, and I'm simply following that intuition. That's a big part of what the book is looking at, that in some of the works he talks about, like Charles Fourier, or this utopian visionary of a future world where new suns are made and where the seas turn into lemonade, but also in Granville, who is this artist who draws these fantastic metamorphoses and transfigurations of machines turning into living things, into animals, and back again, and where there's an artificial world that is a kind of utopia, all kinds of utopias imagined in Granville. So those are things that Benjamin talks about, but that same imaginary is at work in the sciences, and not just in the kind of marginal sciences, not just in the ones that show up later in the dustbin of history, or show up covered in dust in the arcades when Benjamin is wandering through them 100 years later, but in the sciences that built the modern age, that built industrial society. So Humboldt, this huge figure in all the sciences, in setting up all the institutions of modern science in the disciplines, in scientific training and observatories, worldwide scientific communication, setting up standards in ecology, in geophysics, in having a huge impact on biology and on a number of domains of physics as well, he has exactly this kind of Feuerbach or early Marx, Marx 1844 manuscripts era vision of technology as an externalization of the human that then produces a second nature, that through laboring in the outside world, through framing it, through coming up with the concepts that are adequate to both that world and to the demands of the human and its species being, a second nature can be created, which is not necessarily an alienated labor, right? An alienated nature, one in which we are actually in tune with, humans are in tune with their essence through externalizing themselves across this mediation of machines. So there is this theme in a lot of Romanticism. It's there in Wordsworth. It actually partly goes back to Burke, partly goes back to Aristotle, of second nature, that through habits and through thought, through changing our habits, humans produce a new kind of nature, which is natural. It's also this notion of a naturing nature, this 18th century and 17th century in Spinoza, view of nature producing novelty that then becomes a new nature. And sort of following Benjamin, but putting the starting date not in World War I, but in the early 19th century, I'd say that idea is there, that very romantic idea of producing a new nature is there, but with this complete embrace and not rejection of machines and technology. And that actually has an impact not just on politics and the arts. I mean, I'm saying this is the starting point of socialism, of the movements that exploded in 1848. So this idea has an effect on politics. It has an effect on all of the arts, but it also directly feeds into the domain of knowledge we think of as being simply realistic, first nature, which is science. That this view of kind of passing through artifice and passing through technology and the work of framing and adding concepts to make a world picture in science is there in physics, in biology, and it's there in this kind of meta-science that Humboldt proposes in Cosmos. You know, how do we make a unity out of all of these increasingly specialized sciences? And so that series of books, Cosmos, is his kind of Carl Sagan, 200 years in advance, attempt to take out of the specialization that's growing in the sciences, to take from that a lesson of what is the whole, the kind of aesthetic and even moral whole that's being produced.
Well, that's great. John, I was going to ask you more questions, but that your last statement on the kind of importance of cosmic thinking and tying in Benjamin, I think it probably should be the last note of the interview.
Okay, well, that's great. Thanks for these questions. And I mean, there's more stuff in the book, but I'm really grateful to talk with someone who is an expert on the German side of the story, because the obvious place to look at, you know, technology and romanticism, especially in its 20th century consequences, has been Germany, both for romanticism and for National Socialism, which showed up, and you know, both, you know, are important things to confront in thinking. And partly what I wanted to do in the book is take this sort of deviation through the place that the 19th century saw as kind of the center of where everything was happening, and focus on Paris and tell these stories that are part of that narrative but don't get told. I mean, they're part of that development but don't often get told as part of these bigger questions about, or these bigger interrogations of science, technology, and modernity. So to bring some of these characters back, or to take these characters that people like Benjamin let us know the names of but didn't really see in context, and really show this weird world that they're in, and this exciting world that actually turns out to have a lot of consequences for the world we're in now. So I'm really happy to have spoken with somebody, to have spoken with you in particular, because of your interest in monism, but also because you bring these questions coming from the German tradition to this French material. So thank you.
Great. Well, it was a pleasure for me too. And I hope we'll have a chance to speak again soon. Are you working on a new book project, or are you
yes,
taking it easy for now?
No. I've got a new book project. And one is about the U.S. at this time. So in a context where there is less kind of historical predetermination, you know, where the institutional structures aren't really there entirely, where the whole project is to make not just to reform existing institutions, but to build the institutions for the first time. How do some of these thematics, you know, the interplay between nature and you know, how important nature is for the development of the U.S. is just, you know, astonishing, and technology and science in the 1830s to 40s. That's my new book, focusing on someone who Benjamin talks about too, Edgar Allan Poe, and his romanticism, but also his training as an engineer and his popular science writings, and the way in which a new mode of rationality affects the way he writes short stories, but also how he writes about the science of verse and his vision of what the world is like, his own cosmology. So that's what I'm working on now.
Very good. Well, if it's done soon, or if it's not done soon, we can talk about it at another occasion.
Yeah, I look forward to that.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, Sean.
Okay. Thank you, Todd. It's
and just to, for anyone who came late, as though we were on the radio, we've been speaking to John Tresh, the author of The Romantic Machine, which was published by the University of Chicago in 2012. So okay. Thank you very much, John.
Thanks a lot. See you later.